This is an interview with Governor Attia. This is tape two, side two.
Really, when I think back on it, it's kind of a silly reason. The time it made sense. I guess in the whole context, it was they're all good schools. So I think you have to may have turned. Oh, it's not working. That was the context generally. So it was just a matter of deciding where I wanted to go. That was also interesting. My dad said to me, what do you want to do when you go to college? And I said, well, I'd like to be a commercial artist. His comment was, you're nuts, which was the end of that conversation. You know, I remember when my kids went to school, we sat down and did some real debating about the whole thing and debated with your children back and forth, and no debating with my father. I mean, he said, you're nuts, that's it, finished, done.
Huh.
So I went there as pre-law.
At his suggestion?
No, I don't know where it came from, to be honest. I said, well, okay, if I can't do that, I'll go in pre-law. And finished pre-law and was accepted into law school. That's at the end of my sophomore year. But I never returned to college. So I never followed that up.
You hadn't applied to any other schools or anything else?
It was really quite the same. And we weren't going to go, there wasn't even any thought about going elsewhere than in the state of Oregon. I mean, today young people have an opportunity and they know about, and they've been recruited academically now, not athletically, to all kinds of colleges and universities around the nation. My granddaughter's going through the exercise now. Then it wasn't even part of anybody's consideration.
Sure.
You're going to go to school. And we had some of my fraternity brothers from California begin to wonder, how come they come to Oregon? You wonder about it. Because it seemed a little strange to go out of state somewhere to go to a school. So no, there wasn't any discussion. We didn't. Willamette, I thought about because I had the coach come and say he wanted to play football. Never really gave that a great deal of thought. I don't know why, but made the decision as I told you.
And while you were there for that, was it a year and a half, 2 years?
2 years.
2 years. Did you have any particular activities or influential professors that you had, or very interesting classes that you might have
No, I was active in the fraternity house. Incidentally, we pledged Phi Gamma Delta. They're called Fijis. I enjoyed it very much. I think fraternities and sororities are a lot more worthwhile than many people believe they are. But I did learn quite a bit in my fraternity, actually. That is, many things about being able to, first of all, live with other people of different personalities, and you're living close with them, That was something new. We hadn't done that before. We'd just been home and, among our own, my own family.
Did you cook for yourself?
No.
You had a cook for the fraternity house?
There was a cook at the fraternity house. And I think I would have starved if I had to cook for myself. No, they have a cook, and you have your meals. And I learned cooperation. You're cooperating with one another. I learned some things in the fraternity house. I mentioned this professor that spoke about you're in my class now. I remember him. And I remember him, and it's interesting because he did not grade on a curve. And I even signed up the second term with him, which I didn't have to do. I thought, well, this guy's a tough teacher, and that's fine with me. Okay, let's do that. I remember a neat professor in accounting. Remember I told you I wasn't great on numbers. I really struggled with accounting, really struggled. And I recall him. In those days, you sign up for the next term, you'd go to MacArthur Court, and you just walk around and sign up for your classes. Now it's all computerized. But anyway, So I saw this professor, and nice fellow. Vic, he said, I looked and I looked at your finals, just but the best I could give you was a D. And I didn't tell him, but I said to myself, oh, thank God I got a D. I was afraid I was going to, I was afraid I was going to flunk the class.
Well, speaking of accounting, how did you support yourself while you were there? Did you have
I did get a scholarship. Actually, it was, now I think back on it, it was tough. My brothers and I all went at the same time. Three of us in college at the same time. See, they graduated in January of 41, so they really had to wait till September. And then I graduated in June of 41, so
right.
We all went down at the same time. And when I look back on it, you know, that was really tough on my dad. But I did get a what you call scholarship for football. However, I was not one of their big shots. I did get my tuition. I got my student card. And then this was the interesting thing. The really good ball players, they give you certain hours of work. You can work so many hours, 62 and a half cents an hour. And the really good ball players, they got a lot of hours, but they didn't really have to work. Guys like me, we got fewer hours, and we had to work every single minute of our hours. That was the difference between the big shots and guys like me. And so all of that helped. Again, I really wasn't thinking about it, but thinking back, it had to be a considerable help for my father. So that's what I did. Then, of course, we'd come home in the summertime and work at the store.
Had your father gone to college?
Well, he went to American University of Beirut.
That's right.
But I don't, I think he went there. I'm not sure he graduated from college.
And what kind of jobs did you have while you were in college? You said you'd worked.
Well, all of what I told you earlier was basically in high school. The department store, the paper route, that was all basically high school stuff. After that, it was just we'd come back home after school and we'd go to the store work.
Right.
And so it was that altogether. I do remember when you're talking about it, the one class I really, really liked, and I took that my last term as a sophomore, actually my last term in college. And I was sort of filling in. And so I took philosophy. And it just sort of filled in with that one. I had thought about that many times. That did have, make some impression on me. Because I really enjoyed that class. And what I got out of it was a perspective that there are other views. Not just yours. You can always, you could understand other people have views. That had quite an effect on me. Then and in later life and through time on my time in politics and government and governor. And I said, gee, I wish I'd found this sooner. So I just had that one term of philosophy, but this was Plato's Republic. And I can remember reading Plato's Republic, and he was designing the perfect government. And I recall reading that. And he's even talking about taking children in early age, you know, and teaching them and molding them. And I thought to myself, you know, Plato had designed this perfect republic. That's what Plato's Republic was about. He had forgotten, however, one thing. And what he'd forgotten was people. You know, people don't fit the mold that you just designed. They people aren't that way. People are all individuals. Incidentally, it was a very small class. So small, as a matter of fact, we met in the professor's office. A room not much larger than the one we're in, which is now a pretty small room, with a table not much bigger than this. And the thing I can remember is, and now we're sitting very intimately in this room with the professor. It's not a huge class. This one guy would come and go to sleep. Now, I can understand going to sleep in a huge class where nobody can really notice you, but you sure can notice one guy asleep in a small room around a table. But he would do that. anyway, I remember that. But I do recall that philosophy did that. If you talk about an impact that I can identify, mm-hmm. that would certainly be one of them. Mm.
And do you have any other impressions or memories from that period at all?
No, a lot of things, the memories about fraternity life, initiation. We grew a beard. They had a sophomore Whiskerino, and I grew a beard pretty well. So I was the designee for the fraternity house. And I can remember, I couldn't wait till the whole thing was over so I could shave. I learned that I don't like a beard. And I can recall shaving after the whole thing was over that night and burying my face in a cool pillow, and it felt so good. I learned I didn't want a beard.
How would you identify what your political views were at the time, and things that you might have considered politically, or did you?
No. Politics was not something I even thought about.
What did you think in terms of FDR?
I didn't like FDR.
You didn't?
No. Again, I guess there were things that I grew up with or understood as being something important. I can recall when FDR ran for his third term, I was very indignant about that, mm-hmm. in the sense that my thought was, if he thinks that he's the only one that can run this nation, that he doesn't understand our democracy. He doesn't understand. That's why I was indignant, that someone would say, I'm the only one that can do this, nobody else can. I remember that. I did more an analyzing of the FDR period later on than I did at the time, although I do mention this to you, that I recall his third term run. But I never, the whole idea of being what we'd call politically involved just never occurred to me. Just never occurred to me. Didn't think about it. It just, although I say I eventually led to running for the legislature and being actively involved because I was interested. I did have some strong feelings about this country, which just sort of came. I can't really tell you at what point in time. Although I can tell you that my father died, there was this editorial, and I said, gee, this is a great country. You come from that small village mm-hmm. and be a success. This has got to be a great country. I remember that. Mm-hmm. I was interested. I was, as I grew older, watching, politicians doing things, I was maybe more vocal than some, or more emotional about it. Oh gosh, they're doing this thing wrong. I remember reading Kiplinger's letter, and he would write this letter and it'd say, well, such and such is a problem, but this is an election year, so nothing will happen. And I'm indignant. What difference does it make, whether it's an election year or not? If it's a problem, you solve it. That was my Still, I'm not involved politically. Still, I'm not having anything to do with the Republican Party, although I registered Republican when I was 21. Central Committee, nothing. I didn't mm-hmm. do anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your brothers, you said, went into World War II in what year? When was it?
Well, they went 1943, March of 1943.
And I believe that you've mentioned this before, and I can't remember whether it was off tape or on, but about how your brothers both fought in the Battle of the Bulge. And
yeah, yep. They first went to college. They sent a lot of young men that they'd inducted into the, I'm trying to think of the acronym, but anyway, a lot of them went to college. They went to basic and mm-hmm. then to college. But anyway, they were finally put together in an infantry unit, the 106th Division. And then they were sent to Europe. Matter of fact, I'll have to interrupt for a minute because they came home on leave before they were going overseas. That was a typical thing, both of them. And Dolores and I had been going together now since late 40 or December of 40. And so they said, well, and we were officially engaged at that point in time. Well, why don't you guys get married while we're home? So within a week, Salt took place. Married on July 5th. So they came home, and we got married. And then on July 30th, 31st, anyway, the last day of July, my father passed away. My brothers came home again. But anyway, they went overseas, and they went into Belgium, and then finally into the front lines. And that's where the Germans broke through, the Battle of the Bulge, through the 106th Division, their division. And they were relatively new and inexperienced. The interesting coincidence, I mentioned Tom Gault earlier, he was in the infantry. For a while after basic, he stayed there. He finally became a sergeant. He was a trainer for folks in basic. But he was in the 2nd Division. He landed a week after D-Day and was there to the end of the war. He was the only one of his original company left at the end of the war. But anyway, he was in the 2nd Division. 106th replaced the 2nd Division, where Tom was. They never saw each other, but that was what occurred. And then the Germans broke through the 106th, and they were both taken prisoners. They were separated the night before. They were both in the same platoon. And so they were captured separately. And although I may have told you this, Ed knew that Richard was okay, because there was two large compounds. And someone from their division moved from one compound to where Ed was. And he said, Rich is over there. He tried to get there, but obviously the Germans have their own system. So Edward knew Richard was okay, but Richard had no idea what happened to Edward until he finally was released. He came home. Edward came home first. He was released first. He came home first. Then Richard was released. He came home. And as soon as he hit the States, he called home. And his twin brother answered the telephone. That's the first he knew about it. That is, Richard knew about Ed. They both suffered jaundice and malnutrition. They were there for only a few months in prison camp. It was pretty bad. You kind of chuckle about it now, but Ed tells a story of in their prison camp. He said one morning they woke up and they could see the Germans moving around and setting up machine guns, and something unusual was going on. Then they got him out and lined him up and stood him there for a long time. Finally told him that someone had broken into the dining hall and stealing food, and beat one of the guards, German guards, with a meat cleaver or something, and they wanted to know who it was. And they stood him there for an hour or so. Finally, they didn't get the word. And then finally, they went back into the barracks. They came in and they said, we want to know who did this. And you know, until we find out, we're going to start shooting you 10 at a time, alphabetical. Now, this is the time you don't want to be an A. Yeah. And so I said to Ed, what happened? Well, I said, it wasn't within their barracks, but whoever it was, they turned him in. I said, gee whiz, that's tough. Yeah, but he was endangering all these other people. Rich was in a work camp, coal mine. And there he described the Germans shooting Polish soldiers just for no particular reason at all. It wasn't pleasant. It was tough on the Germans at the time. They were actually living off of Red Cross packages, because when the camp was taken over, you know, there's this warehouse with Red Cross packages. The Germans were living off the Red Cross packages. The soldiers weren't getting it. The prisoners weren't getting it. So anyways, it was a short period of time and quite tough. But the really tough part was, of course, I'm home. And I'd been asked to, again, I don't know, if, we didn't cover this, I don't think, on tape. I was called down to the federal building, which is down there by now the Schnitz, across the street from the Schnitz there. And there was an officer down there wanted me to volunteer for the OSS, which is the Office of Strategic Services. That was their kind of behind the line spy kind of thing. And it goes back to French. They knew that I had taken French. And I told them that my father by then had passed away. My brothers were in the service. I was in the business. I said, I can't in good conscience volunteer. I want to go badly. And I really did want to go. Now, if you can take me, I'm glad to go, but I can't volunteer to go. I tell you that story because maybe a couple, 2-3 weeks later, I'm walking back to the store and I see this GI Plymouth sitting in the front of the store, and I thought, my first thought was it's the same guy that I had talked to earlier, an officer. Turns out there was a captain, and he'd come in looking for my father, who by then had passed away quite a bit of time. Said, well, he wasn't there, but I was there, so he waited. Now he reads this telegram. Private Edward E. and Private Richard A. Atiyah are missing in action. That was the telegram. Then we had to go home and tell Mom, or have read the telegram to Mom, which we did. Then we went to theater. I think it was Blue Miles, and I think it was right across the street here. And they showed newsreels. That was what their thing was, not movies. They would show newsreels. Mm-hmm. So we'd go there to see the new newsreels in case we might be able to see, because this was still missing in action. See Ed or Rich. We never did. Then we get a card from Ed. He was a prisoner. This is a Red Cross card. And then he says, Richard's okay. Of course, he knew. Then we got some notice from Richard that he was a prisoner. And so then we knew they were prisoners. So that was an interesting period of time. Mm-hmm. I mentioned my friend Tom. He had some very close calls, obviously had to. And he was, as I told you, only the last one to of his original company. And he was there to the end of the war. My friend Jim, I mentioned, he was over in they called the CBI, China, Burma, India. And he was over in China, in Luoyang, it was an air base there. And then the war, gets, of course, I lost a lot of fraternity brothers. One was a glider pilot who was killed, and one was in the Navy, he was killed. This is in Europe. Several of them, infantry and all. We lost fraternity brothers. My friend Jim, his brother, Dick, younger, graduated from high school, went to basic training, came home for his leave, went to the Philippines and was killed. Just bang, 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 just like that. That's the way that war went. So they were an interesting time to live through. But I think about it, and that I think of people today, young people, relatively, and then I think of myself. I didn't go through World War I, so to me it was all pictures and history. Right. World War I didn't really happen. Although my father-in-law was in World War I, he was a machine gunner, and my friend Jim Campbell's dad was in World War I. But that wasn't real. And so I can understand, younger people, to them World War II isn't real. I mean, they weren't alive at the time. Movies and whatever, history books and things of that kind, but that wasn't real. It's getting to be Korea isn't real pretty soon, although Vietnam still is.
You were in the Coast Guard Temporary Reserve.
Yeah. Our secretary's husband was an older fellow, an engineer. Now, this is a strange way to start the story, but he signed up to go to Alaska, and you get a deferment. You have to sign up for a year, And he went up to Alaska. And all the time he's trying to get a commission, because he keeps worrying about the fact that here he is, a mature engineer, and he's afraid some young punk is going to be an officer over him, and he couldn't stand it. Anyway, he finally couldn't take it any longer. Came home, and incidentally had a pre-induction physical, and flunked it. Now, he didn't have to spend the year in Alaska, but he didn't know that at the time. But anyway, he came in the store one day. He said, hey, you want to join the Coast Guard with me? What are you talking about? And he had discovered this Coast Guard Temporary Reserve. And what this was is folks would sign up and we would patrol the docks here. Well, he never did sign up, but by that evening, I had my physical and I was in the first class that evening. He told me this in the morning. And so I was out there walking the docks. I'd spend 12 hours each week. And it was actually, my shift was midnight to, well, no, wait a minute, no, 6 to 6. 6 in the evening to 6 in the morning. We'd put on our uniform, go out there. They'd say, now you can have a stick or a gun. I always took the gun. I didn't want to get close enough to use a stick if there was anybody around. And it was also interesting. They'd issue you, this is a Smith & Wesson 38 is when we got issued. And they issued the pistol, and they'd issue 5 cartridges. And by God, you'd better come back with that 5 cartridges, or they're going to have court-martial you. And those are the shiniest cartridges in the world. You hand them out and take them back, hand them out and take them back. But it was interesting. Lend-Lease was going on with the Russia, not Lend-Lease, whatever we called it. We were giving Russia a lot of material, and a lot of Russian ships were here. I can recall seeing locomotives being loaded into holds of ships, and they would fill these things up, these Russian ships, just fill them up, and then the captain would put lumber on the top of the deck, and they'd go out. As a matter of fact, during our training session, they were talking about how heavily loaded these ships would be. They were kidding that the Russian captain would sit on the deck with his hand over the rail, and when he could touch water, he'd say, stop loading. but they would go to Vladivostok, and they'd have to be very careful because they'd add an awful lot of ice en route. And that was something I couldn't understand. Huge letters, USSR, on the side of the ship, you know, and we're fighting the Japanese. And somehow I used to think that, you know, how can they do that? You know, the Japanese are going to strike them. Well, I knew, but didn't really think about it, that they weren't fighting the Japanese. They wanted to make sure the Japanese knew this was a Russian ship. And so it was interesting.
They weren't fighting the Japanese?
No, they didn't declare war on Japan until about the last, I don't know, a week? Two or three weeks, just before the end of the war.
So all this material was going...
It was going to Russia.
Going to
fight the Germans.
To fight the Germans.